All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome, everyone, to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type, United States Army, Republic of Vietnam, 1969. Flew helicopters. But, hey, I gotta give a big shout-out right now to the Yankee Air Museum for their Thunder Over Michigan program the last 2 days. I was out there a little bit this afternoon, and, wow, it was very impressive and very loud. A lot of jets, helicopters, static displays, and so on and so forth. So I really do want to give them a great shout out for a great performance by all those participants out there. And the place was surrounded by thousands and thousands of people. It was great. It's a real show for what American air power is, you know, past and present. And there were a number of helicopters out there, which of course is what I really like. But boy, did we go slow in comparison. They had a jet, and I don't know which jet it was, that it looked like it was standing on its tail at about 1,000 feet and almost stopped, and then he went straight up from there. I can't imagine the G stress and everything else that was on him, but it was a really amazing, amazing show, and so the Yankee Air Museum gets a big kudos there. I want to welcome everybody to Veterans Radio today, especially to my veteran brothers and sisters. Thank you for your service, and all of you that came home, welcome home, and for those that did not, never forget, and always remember, and we will always do that here on Veterans Radio. At the beginning of the program today, we're going to be talking with one of our guests about some upcoming events, and then, of course, our main guest today is Stephen Harding, and his book is entitled The Castaway's War, which is a great story. You've got to really hang around for that one, about a World War II veteran whose ship was sunk in the Pacific and ended up, you know, surviving barely on an island out there, sort of a Robinson Crusoe type of story. But right now I want to get to one of our guests on the phone right now, and that's a good friend of ours here at Veterans Radio, and that is Bob Gillette. And Bob, I understand that you are driving, so I'll get you taken care of right away. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Dale. Thank you very much.
The reason I asked you to come on the program, of course, was to talk about your upcoming event on September 10th. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. We have the Louisville Slugger Amputee Warriors coming to Detroit to play the Detroit Connection at Jimmy John's Stadium at 1 o'clock on September 10th. These Warriors were all in the service before 9/11, were injured in either Afghanistan and Iraq, went to either the VA hospital or Walter Reed, and then went out to Arizona to learn to play softball. And so they all served immediately after 9/11, and this Sunday, the 11th, is going to be the 15th anniversary, so it's ironic that these young men are going to be in Detroit, and we'd like them, and they have a story told also.
Well, I think it's fascinating because we met a number of the ballplayers this last week at another fundraiser that you helped out with.
Correct.
It's a documentary. We're going to talk about it, not today, but later on, trying to help people, you know, trying to prevent suicide, which I know is not the right term, but to try and help people.
That's correct.
And so we're going to be talking about that more later on. But I met three of these young men and a young woman who was at that fundraiser, and just amazing, amazing young people. And we have every reason to be proud of these young men and women. And I was so surprised that how articulate they were, and that's passionate about what they are doing. And I can't wait to see this game. There are pictures, actually. If you want to go and find out more, if you go to the Facebook page for the Louisville Slugger Warriors, there's all kinds of information on that. But remember, write down on your calendar Saturday, September 10th at 1 o'clock, Jimmy John's Field in Utica, Michigan. It looks like it's going to be a great afternoon, and from what I saw on their little videos that they have there, these guys are very talented players, too.
They are indeed. They are indeed.
And so, Bob, as usual, I want to thank you very much for being on the program, and thank you, of course, for helping support all of these veterans' issues out there, and I'll be talking to you later. Make sure you drive safely today.
Thank you again, Dale. Do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
That was Bob Gillette, former owner of the American House Senior Living Communities all around southeastern Michigan, and very actively involved in veterans' issues and affairs, and supports a lot of fundraising activities that go on in the southeastern Detroit area. And I'm amazed all the time that I find out about all these people in the local area that want to help veterans so much. It's such a great way of taking care of veterans, and especially showing them how much we really do care about them. You know, sometimes in past times, sometimes that message wasn't necessarily strongly given out. And so we want to make sure that we continue doing that as we go along with that. A couple of other events that I've heard about coming up. And number one is from the Legal Help for Veterans. Hey, I know those guys. Jim Falzone sent me an email saying to remind everybody of the 7th Annual Veterans Summit, sponsored by the Canton Community, or put on by the Canton Community Foundation and Legal Help for Veterans, on September 20th in Westland. And this has got all kinds of health care providers. There's going to be employers. There's going to be how to get a job. All kinds of different events that are going to be going on, healthcare, business, disability benefits, people there. There are going to be service advocates there and help you with claims if you have, if you've had some difficulty filing your claim or getting your claim approved. It's a free event. You need to register, though, for this. So you need to go to cantonfoundation.org. That's cantonfoundation.org, or you can give them a call at 734-495-1200. That's 734-495-1200, and register for this event. It's absolutely free, and as I've said, they're going to be able to talk about your health care, business foundation, business formation, and possibly business funding and disability benefits at this free event. It's the 7th annual one. I'm sure that Bob or myself will probably show up at that, just to see what's going on. It's always good to see what people are doing to help out their fellow veterans. It's a good time. It's a good time for everybody, and I think that the Canton Foundation does a great work with this, and we want to thank them for putting that on all the time. The last thing I have for today is that the USS Detroit, guess what? We didn't know you had a ship named after Detroit, did you? Well, we have a new one. And it's going to be commissioned on October 22nd of 2016. And they said, the email I got was, it's official. The Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, has officially confirmed October 22nd, 2016, for the commissioning of the USS Detroit. The ship itself will arrive in Detroit on Friday, the 14th of October, for 8 days of tours, VIP visits, celebrations, and other events. And the actual ceremony will take place on Saturday, the 22nd. Of October. That's pretty nifty too, I think. So we want to make sure that you get there. It says some of the events, as I'm reading this, the public is encouraged to visit the ship itself. You'll be able to go on board and see what it's all about. I'm not from the Navy, so I don't know a whole lot about ships, but I'm thinking this would be kind of neat. The GM Riverwalk is going to be a buzz because there's going to be all kinds of ceremonies going on there. And this is the USS Detroit is a Freedom Class combat ship. The new high-tech USS Detroit is the 6th U.S. Army, or the U.S. Navy. There's a slip. U.S. Navy warship to bear the city's names. Fast, agile ship designed for a variety of missions in coastal waters as well as humanitarian relief missions. Capable of open sea operations or modular design, supports interchangeable mission packages, which will allow the ship to be reconfigured for anti-sub warfare, mine warfare, and surface warfare missiles as needed. Sounds pretty cool. It was launched on October 18th, 2014. And I think that it's all been fitted out, tested out, ready to go. So mark your calendar, October 22nd, 2016, the U.S. Detroit commissioning, right on the riverfront, downtown Detroit. Put it down, be there. All right, we're going to be taking a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Stephen Harding, the author of The Castaway's War. This is a great story. Stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and as you could tell by the theme music right there, this is all about the Navy today. My guest joining me on the line right now is Stephen Harding, and Stephen is the author of 9 previous books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Last Battle, which is in the Europe campaign, and he's like a longtime specialist, journalist specializing in military affairs, and currently is editor-in-chief of the Military History Magazine. You've got contributions on defense topics on aviation, military, maritime history has appeared in Time, The Daily Beast, San Francisco Chronicle, Air and Space, Smithsonian, World War II, Jane's Defense Weekly, and Air Enthusiast. Stephen Harding, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, it's great to be here, Dale. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you here. How's your weather out in Virginia?
Right at the moment, it has calmed down. It was kind of lively a few minutes ago. We're having a string of severe thunderstorms all up and down the East Coast, but I think we've got a clear spot going for us now.
Okay. Well, Stephen, I want to thank you for coming onto the program. I'll start off with a thank you early on. And also for whoever it was that sent me this book, The Castaway's War, One Man's Battle Against Imperial Japan. This is a story of Hugh Barr Miller. Tell me a little bit about who he really was.
Well, Hugh Miller was born in Tuscaloosa, Alabama in 1910. He was kind of what you would call the son of the Southern aristocracy. His father and grandfather were both lawyers, very famous men. In fact, his grandfather was a state legislator. And Hugh grew up splitting his time between Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and the family had a plantation in Hazelhurst, Mississippi. So Hugh spent summers on that plantation, and as he was growing up, a family retainer named James Michael, everybody called him Uncle Jim, taught Hugh and his brother literally everything there was to know about the outdoors, how to camp, how to fish, how to shoot, how to track, all about camouflage. All of this was sort of what boys of his generation and his standing learned in those days. And they were all things that were going to help him out quite a bit in World War II.
Right. And then he went off to school at the University of Alabama.
He did indeed. And he was a football player while he was there. Mm-hmm. He played under Coach Wallace Wade, who a lot of people are going to remember. In fact, Hugh played in the Rose Bowl on January 1st, 1931, when Alabama beat Washington State by something like 32-0.
Wow.
Apparently not much of a game. But one of the important things to remember, Dale, is that Wallace Wade is this huge figure in football coaching. And he had a saying that a man who won't be beaten can't be beaten. And that was an ethic that Hugh took to heart. And again, it was something that would stand him in good stead during the war.
I think we're going to find that there were a lot of previous influential men and women in his life prior to World War II that had a great influence on his being able to survive his trials and tribulations.
Indeed, indeed. And actually, Hugh was also a fairly devout young man for that time and place. And he, very straightforward, church-going kind of guy, and that also would help him. One of the things that was interesting about Hugh is that he graduated from the University of Alabama, and he became a lawyer in the years right before World War II. And even before Pearl Harbor, he decided that, the United States was probably going to get into the war, and he wanted to do his part. So he enlisted in the Naval Reserve, and he was commissioned in October 1941, if I remember correctly. But because he was an attorney, they essentially had him doing attorney things, and he was posted to Key West in Florida. And he was getting a little tired of essentially being a desk officer. Yeah. And at some point in the spring of 1942, a lieutenant commander named Joseph Wellings came through Key West. Now, Wellings was on his way to being the commander of a destroyer that at that point was being built up in Maine. And somehow, and we're not entirely sure how, Hugh Miller talked Joseph Wellings into taking him on as a seagoing officer. And bear in mind that Hugh had absolutely no experience at sea, but he wanted to serve and he wanted to be a seagoing naval officer, and he had his way. So you could certainly say that Joseph Wellings and the man who was his executive officer, a guy named Fred Purdy, were huge influences on Hugh as he made that transition from being a naval attorney to being a surface warfare officer.
I would think so. And so you were talking about the USS Strong.
Exactly.
Being the ship that was being built and commissioned. And so they were on that. Could you describe the Strong to our audience?
Yeah, the Strong was a new class of destroyer. It was called a Fletcher-class destroyer, and it was among the first ones built. It was built at the Bath Iron Works in Maine, and the Fletchers were the first real class of World War II destroyers to incorporate a lot of the changes that we had learned from the British and their operations. World War II started, as your listeners know, in 1939, and by the time we got into it in 1941, the British had several years of experience using destroyers both for anti-submarine and surface warfare. So the Fletchers included a lot of that technology. They had five-inch guns, they had torpedo tubes, they had depth charges, and increasingly, as the war went on, they had greater and greater numbers of anti-aircraft guns.
Right. And so when the Strong was commissioned, and where did Hugh pick it up or get on?
He was what they call a plank owner in the Navy. And like you, Dale, I was not in the Navy. I was in the Army a long time ago. So I had to learn all the technology and the terminology.
Well, you do a great job of explaining it in the book. And, you know, we are talking with Stephen Harding. The book is The Castaway's War. And there's such detail in here that it just helps you go along on this journey of following Hugh as he goes off into the Pacific. And as you said, I didn't know any of the terminology or jargon of the Navy or that much about it. So Hugh is on the ship first day almost.
Exactly. He was aboard from the time it was launched until the time it was actually commissioned and went to sea. Now, initially, Strong spent time off the east coast of North America in the Caribbean, and it actually escorted a convoy to North Africa. But in January 1943, it crossed through the Panama Canal into the Pacific and eventually made its way to a place called Espiritu Santo in the New Hebrides, which is now the island nation of Vanuatu. And from there, it ran escorts to and from Guadalcanal. And Hugh his job on the ship was machine gun officer. Now, unlike what machine gun means to you and I, Dale,
right.
In those days, machine gun also included 20-millimeter cannon, which are very large weapons. And Strong had these for anti-aircraft defense. And Hugh was put in charge of all the 20-millimeter guns, and he trained his gun crews pretty much the same way Wallace Wade had trained his football teams. They all worked as a team. They worked together. They worked to coordinate their activities. And Hugh was sort of both the coach and the captain of the team on board the ship. And so by the time they got to the Pacific, they were, although they had not yet been in combat, they were as ready as anybody could be.
So and where was Hugh's perch, so to speak, on the Strong?
Hugh wanted to have the best possible view he could have of the surrounding area, so he posted himself on what's called the flying bridge. It's directly above the actual enclosed ship's bridge on a Fletcher-class destroyer. And if your listeners want to go aboard a Fletcher-class destroyer, the USS Kidd in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is the most World War II-looking Fletcher-class still around these days. So right above it, above the enclosed bridge, is the flying bridge, sometimes called the signal bridge. And it's essentially just flat steel plate with a railing around it. And coming up behind it is a mast that has radar antenna and so on. And Hugh stationed himself up there with his sound-powered phones and two of his lookouts so that the three of them, Hugh and these two enlisted sailors, would essentially stand back-to-back. And if they needed to, they could sort of revolve themselves. So they were always getting a 360-degree view around the ship. The first warning of enemy aircraft, of course, would come from radar. But as we know, in World War II, Japanese aircraft often snuck through under the radar of U.S. Navy ships. Mm-hmm. So it allowed Hugh the best possible view, around the entire ship so that he could direct the guns himself or get incoming messages from the radar plot.
How big is a Fletcher destroyer?
To put it in terms that your listeners would understand, it's, you know, think in terms of about 300 feet. It depends on which series the ship was built in and some other things, but it would be dwarfed by any modern destroyer. Modern U.S. Navy destroyers are the size really of light cruisers of World War II. So the Strong is when you walk up to, for example, to the USS Kidd, which I did when I was researching the book, it's a good-sized warship. I spent a lot of time as a defense journalist on Army ships, and yes, Dale, the Army does have ships. But yeah, they do. That's something people are always stunned to find out. But the Kidd is a very impressive vessel, as were all Fletcher-class destroyers, because the ship was built for one purpose, to go to war.
Right.
And it looks like it when you come up on it.
All right, so he's way out there in the South Pacific. Whereabouts? You mentioned it was near Guadalcanal, and were they running? What kind of missions were they running?
They were mainly running convoy escorts from Espiritu Santo and the New Hebrides up to Guadalcanal. But then, beginning in March 1943, they started also undertaking surface bombardment missions, where Strong would join other vessels in bombarding Japanese positions, primarily in and around the coasts of what is known as Kula Gulf. Kula Gulf is a fairly large body of water that's bounded to the east by the island of New Georgia, to the west by the island of Kolombangara, and sort of to the southwest by a smaller island called Arundel. And all of these islands were, at that period of time, occupied by the Japanese. So Strong and the other destroyers, and also light cruisers, would run in very quickly at night and bombard Japanese positions that they would then be bombed by aircraft during the day. The whole idea, of course, would be to keep up essentially an around-the-clock bombardment before American troops landed.
Right, so this is kind of the beginning of the island hopping of the Marines and so forth, to, you know, headed toward Tokyo at some point.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's kind of jump forward a couple of months in this and to the morning of July 5th, 1943. We've got about 4 minutes before we need to take a break.
The quick setup on this, Dale, is that on the night of 4-5 July, Strong was doing one of these bombardment missions with some other destroyers and three light cruisers, and they were bombarding both Kolombangara, targets on Kolombangara and New Georgia. And after midnight, as they were turning, essentially the mission was over and they were turning back north through Kula Gulf to end the mission and go back towards Guadalcanal and then to their home base on Espiritu Santo, some Japanese destroyers were coming in the north part of Kolombangara, saw on radar, because one of the Japanese ships was one of the few Japanese vessels then that had radar, they saw these American vessels, so they decided to turn around and go the other way. But as they were turning around, they fired a spread of what are now known as long lance torpedoes. These were Japanese Type 93 torpedoes. So think of a weapon that's more than 20 feet long and has a 1,000-pound warhead. Hmm. And at 11 miles, it was a luck shot, but unfortunately, one of those torpedoes hit Strong. And that's where Hugh Miller's real story starts.
Right, absolutely. So the Strong is hit by this torpedo. What happened initially to the ship itself?
The torpedo basically just broke Strong's back. It sank, but not before another destroyer was able to come alongside and take off most of the crew. Hugh Miller stayed on board because he was helping to make sure everybody had gotten off the ship, and he actually went into the water when the ship sank, and he went into the water unharmed. He even managed to rescue a couple of sailors, but then right after they went into the water, Strong's own depth charges started to go off, and Hugh was one of the many people horribly injured by the detonation of these depth charges, which, as you know, Dale, are designed to, you know, destroy submarines. So imagine what they can do to a human body.
I was just going to say that this was one of the really interesting and very scary parts of the book for me, was that he was in the water and these depth charges are going off, and it's the shock waves and what it's doing to his body and to those other sailors that were in the water with him.
Indeed, indeed. You're talking about what is now known as immersion blast syndrome, which is a fairly dull name for a whole series of really horrific injuries.
Wow. All right. So he's in the water and his insides are getting all messed up.
Indeed. That's the best way to put it.
To put it mildly. And so in the book, you describe the various types of rescue craft and rafts and so forth that had come off the Strong and were helping them up. Could you describe one of those? It was called a net or something, right?
Yeah, it's called a floater net.
Okay, I'm sorry. I got to stop you here for just a second. I got less than a minute. So I want to just remind people that we are talking with Stephen Harding. His book is The Castaway's War. It's a story. It's an amazing story of Lieutenant Hugh Miller, who is a football star at the University of Alabama in our town. We know all about that stuff, and he participated in a winning Rose Bowl game. And I want to encourage you, if you have any questions for Steve, give us a call here at Veterans Radio, 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. This story is going to just blow you folks away. You won't believe what happens to Hugh Miller after we come back after the news. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are remembering Pearl Harbor. We're talking today with our guest, Stephen Harding, the author of The Castaway's War, the story of Hugh Miller, who evidently did remember Pearl Harbor when he enlisted as in the reserves prior to World War II in the Navy. He was a football player at the University of Alabama. He was a lawyer in Alabama, never probably gotten that close to the ocean. And the next thing you know, he's on a destroyer that gets hit by Japanese torpedoes. And his ship is blown in half. He's blown into the water. Depth charges are going up, scrambling up his interior. And now he's trying to save his men. So, Stephen, let's go back at it.
So at this point, Dale, Hugh was taken aboard what is called a floater net. Imagine a cargo net, the kind you see people climbing up and down on the sides of ships during World War II films. Okay. It was that, but it also had flotation devices attached to it. So when the ship sank, these nets, along with the life rafts, would float free of the sinking vessel, and they provided enough flotation that several people could pull themselves up onto the net. Now, you were not dry, obviously, because it is a net, and it's got water sloshing in and out of it. But it was at that point, Hugh was essentially unconscious, and he was taken aboard this net with many other people. Over the following days, as we often see in films, several of the men aboard the net died of their injuries and were, with great honor, let go to the sea at that point. Other people were sick with internal injuries. They did have some fresh water and small amounts of food that were in waterproof cans attached to this net. But over time, the sun, the ocean, and their injuries took a very large toll. So finally, a few days after the sinking, Hugh Bar Miller was one of only a handful of men that was still on this floater net, and they grounded up on the edge of a small island, the Arundel Island that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. By this point, Hugh was in very, very bad shape, two of the other gentlemen who came ashore with him died either right before they reached the island or just after. So at that point, it was Hugh and three young sailors who were essentially uninjured. Their last names were Armbruster, Lawrence, and Mullane. And these three young sailors did everything they could to take care of Hugh, but he was convinced that he was dying. And as I describe in the book, he had good reason for thinking that, given the symptoms that he was displaying and the things that were going on.
He wasn't able to hold too much in.
He was not in any way. And he couldn't take in water. And again, they also had all of them had swallowed heavy fuel oil. They were sunburned. And the island was far from a tropical paradise. There were insects and various other things that were sort of tormenting him. So at one point, Hugh was absolutely convinced that he was dying, and he saw no point in the three young men hanging around with him until they themselves got captured and likely killed by the Japanese. So he ordered them to leave him. And not only did he order them to leave, he gave them his shoes, his knife, and some other items. They did it very reluctantly, but they ultimately, he literally ordered them to leave. And sadly, those three young men have not been seen since then. They're still listed as MIA.
Right.
And Hugh, much to his surprise, I think, did not die. He didn't get well very quickly. In fact, he never really got well again. But over the following days, he was able to finally start drinking rainwater, and he found a way to open coconuts. And any of your listeners that have ever had to open a freshly fallen coconut know just how vexing a task that can be. They're almost impossible to open unless you have an axe or a very sharp knife, which he did not have. But he figured out a way to open them. And over the following days and weeks, as his strength gradually returned, he determined that he was going to live through essentially being shipwrecked, and he was determined that he would eventually be rescued. The only problem was that the Japanese were alerted to his presence on the island because he, on one of the first days he was able to move around, he found the body of a Japanese soldier floating just offshore. And in his desire for shoes and the man's bayonet and some other things, he stripped the body. And then by the time he got back to shore, he realized that was probably not the smartest thing to do because the Japanese came around collecting the bodies, and they found one that was devoid of all of the clothing and equipment.
Wow. It's amazing, though, that all of the things that Hugh learned in his childhood and in his early adulthood is starting to come into play here.
Exactly. He was one of those people, Dale, that he wasn't frightened by being outdoors. It was something he knew and loved, and he knew how to survive on his own. And so as his health gradually got better, he was able to find shelter, and by foraging initially Japanese bodies that he found washed up on shore, he was able to, replenish his meager food stocks with some Japanese rations. He found some insect repellent that worked quite well, as a matter of fact. But it was the other part of the time on the island that is really amazing. Hugh Miller was a very dedicated naval officer.
Mm-hmm.
And his point of view was, as long as I'm alive, I need to take the fight to the enemy. And the Japanese were patrolling Arundel Island looking for him. So a good part of the book is taken up with their efforts to find him and the ways he not only evaded capture, but managed to start taking the war to the Japanese.
And he did it really effectively.
He did. He managed to scrounge a fair number of Japanese hand grenades. And now this is a guy who was a football player. He could put these grenades very accurately out to a fair distance, and that's what he started doing because he was not able to come up with a firearm. But he managed to start killing Japanese with their own hand grenades.
And some of them, and folks, you got to read it. The book is the Castaways of War by Stephen Harding. It's the story of Hugh Miller, and he's finding these weapons out there from the Japanese are being killed. Some of them by the bombardments of the ships, that were doing the same thing that his ship was doing. And one of the stories that I loved was about how he found the wet ones, and they, he didn't know if it was going to go off or not go off. And so he's trying to get them all dried out. Because I guess, I'll let you describe, how did the Japanese hand grenades actually work?
Well, unlike the American grenades that you and I are familiar with, the Japanese hand grenades, they did have a pin, but they had a small cylindrical sort of pencil-shaped device sticking out of the top that you pulled the pin, and then you smack that round device up against something hard to start the fuse burning. And as you said, when Hugh got the first two grenades that he was able to find, they had been soaking in seawater, and he wasn't sure they were going to go off. So he put them out in the sun, and he let them, try and dry out. But when he pulled that first pin and smacked it on a rock, he ran the very real risk of the thing going off in his hand.
And
it was, it was sort of do or die at that point.
Well, obviously he was able to get them to work, and I love the ideas of some of the things that are inside of the book themselves, or, you know, how creative he got. You know, he found a couple of empty beer bottles, and so what he would do is he would fill those up with water, and those were sort of his canteen, and it was like a, oh, I can't even think of the name right now, but he would catch the rain as it was coming off of the leaves and fill up his bottles of water, making sure that he was hydrated at all times. And,
exactly.
And, you know, and eating some of the foods, which, as you describe in the book, were not the most appetizing to somebody from a different culture.
Exactly.
And then he, as we go along here, he starts the, you used varsity and junior varsity terms in here of the search teams for him. Could you describe that just a little bit for our audience?
Sure. The what I call the junior varsity were the first Japanese troops that started searching for him. They obviously either had not been in service very long or weren't taking it very seriously, because they'd talk while they were walking and they'd carry their rifles over their shoulders. The same thing we always see young soldiers doing when they're new to the service. After a while, though, after Hugh started taking the war to the Japanese, they brought in the varsity team. These were the guys who were very experienced jungle fighters. They were absolutely quiet as they moved through the brush, and it was really only Hugh Miller's expertise himself as a outdoorsman and a woodsman that allowed him to escape what were very effective search techniques. And as he did that, even as good as he was, they almost caught him more than once, as I describe in the book. One of the reasons I really liked this story, Dale, when I first came across it was, to me, I kind of describe it as a cross between Robinson Crusoe and the sands of Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. You know, there was not only you're shipwrecked, you're hurt, you have nothing sort of, you know, shipwreck story, but then there's the idea that you are fighting a war and the enemy is actively looking for you. And the way Hugh Miller rose to those challenges, I just find a fascinating story. He was an incredible human being, and I really felt like I really had to tell this story.
Well, you've done a great job of telling a story, and of course, there's much, much more to it in the book. The book is The Castaway's War by Stephen Harding. You can get it anywhere, pretty much, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. The other things that I was so shocked about was the meticulous notes that Miller was taking while he was on the island, because he was gathering intelligence at the same time.
He was. He decided that, again, as a naval officer, it was his duty to take the war to the Japanese, and part of that was trying to figure out, the Japanese were doing a lot of nocturnal troop resupply missions using small landing craft, and they were hugging the coast of Arundel Island on their way to New Georgia. So he found a lookout location that allowed him to see these landing craft, to sort of clock their movements, when they were moving, where they hid out during the day, that sort of thing, that would come in very, very handy later on.
Well, I don't want to give away the whole thing. Obviously, he got off the island. That story you have to read yourself, folks. It's just, again, it's another amazing part of this man. So he gets off the island and, you know, he's awarded the Navy Cross, and he gets to meet who?
He got to meet Eleanor Roosevelt.
Of all people.
The First Lady was actually on a Red Cross tour of the South Pacific, and when Admiral William Halsey, people generally know him as Bull Halsey, although he really hated that nickname, Halsey wanted to award him the Navy Cross, and Eleanor Roosevelt was on New Caledonia where Hugh ended up in the hospital, and she awarded it, co-awarded it to him with Admiral Halsey. There's a picture of it in the book. It's just a great image, because while he was on the island, Hugh lost 43 pounds, and trust me, Dale, he didn't have that to lose when he started.
Right, he didn't look like a big, I mean, he's a tall guy, but skinny guy in the later pictures, of course.
Yeah, he looks kind of like he's on the mend, but not entirely there yet in this picture of him and Halsey and Eleanor Roosevelt. And then, of course, after the war, his story was very well known initially. And at one point, the story of his life, it appeared, or the story of his adventures, it appeared in Life magazine and some other places. And no less an actor than John Wayne. Now, John Wayne was, what, 6'4"? He wasn't that big, but John Wayne wanted to play him in the movies. It didn't work out for various reasons, and eventually Robert Stack was going to play him, and that didn't work out. And the movie never got made, although I'd like to let you know that it looks like it will now, because the book has been optioned as a motion picture.
Oh, good. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. I can't wait to see this on film myself. I think it's just a great story.
It's a timeless story is really what it is. It could be any conflict anywhere at any time, and you're behind enemy lines. Now how do you get out of here? And I think that story, you mentioned in the book as you were talking that he was awarded the Navy Cross. And he was denied the upgrade to the Medal of Honor. Any thoughts on that?
He was. Admiral Halsey himself, just after the war, had essentially decided, once he'd heard the full story of Hugh's exploits on Arundel Island, he decided that he would have preferred to put Hugh in for the Medal of Honor. There was at that time, however, a time limit on when the medal could be given, how long after the fact. It was at that point 5 years. And even though a special act of Congress removed that restriction for Hugh specifically, the then Secretary of the Navy decided against it. There has been talk on and off since then of seeking an upgrade for Hugh. It's one of those things, though, Dale, that when we talk about the Medal of Honor, we talk about such a high bar, and to go back now 70 some odd years and try and redetermine, what happened and how, that it would be a very, very difficult lift. I think it's warranted, but I think it would be very difficult to do.
Right. We just had an incident of that. In fact, next week we're going to be talking with the latest Medal of Honor recipient from our own Ypsilanti area. That's Charlie Kettles, who was an Army helicopter pilot. And they upgraded his Distinguished Service Cross to a Medal of Honor. And it really came down to that they were able to find some survivors of, the incident that he was written up for in the beginning. And I think it'd probably be a lot more, who witnessed it?
Exactly. I mean, the most direct witnesses were the Japanese soldiers he killed. So, there were other Americans who took part in various parts of the story, but yeah, it would be very difficult to do. And I have to say that I've spent a lot of time in Army helicopters, and I think helicopter pilots deserve all the accolades we can give them. Myself.
Well, I'll accept that. Thanks. Thanks. I was telling somebody the other day. This is a quick aside: is that when Colonel Kettles was awarded his Medal of Honor, as he said, it's for all the helicopter pilots. It's for all the the crew chiefs, door gunners, everything else, and the grunts on the ground. They're so humble. It really kind of comes back at you, and you realize how much everybody was so interconnected to each other. And
exactly.
I think that's great.
I'm also very indebted to Army medics. They happen to have saved my life. So, over the course of my professional life, I've been in conflict zones from Northern Ireland to Iraq, and I always make a point of singling out, medics for a slap on the back.
Oh, absolutely. I want to take a little break here and come back and talk to you about some of the other things that you have written.
Okay.
And maybe what's coming up in the future. So everybody just stay tuned. We're talking with Stephen Harvey. The book is The Castaway's War, the story of Hugh Miller. You got to go out and get this one. You won't believe the stuff that this guy went through. We're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be right back. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and our guest today is Stephen Harding, whose book that we've been talking about for the last little bit is The Castaway's War. It's a gripping story of survival and quiet heroism. The accolades that are coming in, and now it's been optioned for a movie. I can't wait to see that. But Stephen, you've done other things.
I have. Two things in my life. after I got out of the Army, I went back to school and got some degrees in history and ended up as a journalist. And as I mentioned earlier, I specialized in military and defense topics. So I spent time in various delightful places around the world. And for the last 9 years, I've been the editor of Military History Magazine. I also write books, obviously. I I did a book 4 years ago that also has options as a movie called The Last Battle, which is the true story of the only time in World War II when American soldiers and German soldiers actually joined forces and fought together. And they did it to defend a medieval castle in Austria. I think it's going to make also a great film. I'd love to see both of these films done at the same time myself.
It would be great. But, yeah, tell me a little bit, because I just started reading this one. You mentioned that the Germans and the American forces get together. This is at the in the last
literally the last few days of World War II in Europe. There was a castle in the Tyrol part of Austria called Castle Itter, and it was a place that the Germans used to incarcerate high-value French prisoners, former generals, prime ministers, and their wives. And during the last few days of the war, Heinrich Himmler ordered the Waffen-SS unit to go to the castle and kill everybody in it. And that's not just the French prisoners, but also the German guards. The German guards heard that and evaporated away, but in a local small town, there was a German unit headed by a gentleman named Sepp Gangl, a highly decorated German officer who had decided that the war was over. There was enough killing. So he went out and found the closest American unit, which was part of the 12th Armored Division, and said, look, the SS is on their way to kill these people in this castle. What say we join forces and protect it? And the guy leading the tank outfit, which was a tank company, was a guy named Jack Lee from Norwich, New York, actually. And he said he was the kind of guy, Jack Lee was the kind of guy who had found his niche in war. Doesn't mean he was a warmonger. It just means he was very good at it. And so he took a leap of faith, joined forces with this German officer and some of his men, and they literally defended this castle. It's the only time in American military history when American soldiers fought to defend a castle, which I just think is a great thing. And think of the visuals involved in that.
I am, just as you're mentioning, it's like Hogwarts or something like that. With all that. So that book is entitled The Last Battle. And
exactly.
I think we got to get you back on to talk about that one. You also did this kind of a collection of a reference book of Army aviation.
That was early on in my career because I had been in the Army, and because I spent a lot of time in Army aircraft, I decided to put together a book of all of the aircraft the Army has ever used, which, as you will probably now know, includes not just the usual helicopters, but four-engine propeller aircraft, right, jet fighters, hovercraft, jet packs. It was kind of an interesting thing for me to do, and it's still that came out years ago, but it's still in wide use because it is the only single guide to all of the aircraft the Army has ever used. And I did the same thing for Army vessels.
Now I can go look at the ships.
You could look at the ships, everything from landing craft to LSTs and all kinds of good stuff. I mean, the Army is a much more broad spectrum service, I think, than a lot of people imagine.
I agree. At the air show today, they had a helicopter display, and there were Hueys and Loaches and Cobras and OH-13s and all kinds of really, you know, old type Army aircraft, which was just fascinating. But they really did move a whole lot slower than the fast burners that they had out there. All right, so what's coming up next for you?
Well, I have a new book coming out on November 22nd called Dawn of Infamy, which is the true story of what might have been, and you have to read the book to figure out if it was or not, it might have been the first American ship sunk by the Japanese on the day of Pearl Harbor, but it wasn't in Hawaii. It was halfway between Seattle, Washington, and Honolulu when it was sunk by a Japanese submarine. And that one act could well have changed the course of World War II. And I will actually be in Honolulu in December for the 75th anniversary commemoration of Pearl Harbor. And if any of your listeners happen to be there, I'd be happy to speak with them.
Well, I think we'll have to get you back here in November to talk about that book. And then, of course, with the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor coming up, then we'll get you on as our resident expert on that. How does that sound?
I'd be happy to do it, Dale.
All right. Well, Stephen Harding, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. The book is The Castaway's War, A One Man's Battle Against Imperial Japan. It's a great war story, humanitarian story. This is somebody that you need to find out about is Hugh Miller. It's truly one of those greatest generation members. And thanks for writing that, and I can't wait to read all the rest of them. Thanks, Stephen.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dale. It was my pleasure.
Okie dokie. All right. Thank you very much. All right. So that's today's program. Next week, we are going to have Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Kettles on the program. As I mentioned, he is the most recent Medal of Honor recipient, and some of you know the story. We've talked to Colonel Kettles a number of times on the program, but we're also going to have another one of the pilots that was there that day that's going to be here to talk about how he perceived what happened. And he only received a Distinguished Flying Cross and a Silver Star for what he did there. So I can't wait till next week. I encourage you to go to veteransradio.net. Follow us on Facebook. We're putting some new things up there. And the other thing that I want to remind everybody right now is we're starting a new campaign. It's called Fly Your Flag Project. And if you live in the local Ann Arbor area, and hopefully this area will expand, if you've got your flag out there, don't be surprised if sometime in the next couple of weeks you get a little postcard from Veterans Radio saying thank you for flying your flag. Maybe it'll get the other people in your neighborhood to fly their flag as well. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry saying thanks for listening, and you are dismissed. Thank you.